accession number 26756, Reel 2.
On the parachute, of course, yeah. We were guarded by Yugoslav partisans, and I remember in the evening climbing up a fig tree, just for the pleasure of climbing up and eating a fig, and a whole mass of automatic fire suddenly came at me, so I climbed out again rather rapidly. And there was, well, he had one American who was extremely large, so he had an extra large parachute. But no, it was a good course, it was fascinating. Very quick, I felt very confident. We only did four drops. But we couldn't do a night drop because it was too windy, so our fourth drop was done in daylight, all out of Decatur's. And then the sabotage course, I can't remember. It may have been at San Vito, or I think ME-102. That's right, San Vito, I've written down, but I can't remember what that was. And I never had a chance to put the sabotage training into operation, as I say. Therefore, it is a skill still waiting to be used.
Where were you staying during this period when you were doing the training?
In a barn, in an orchard, as far as I remember.
Do you remember much about that sort of side of the course, the social side, or the?
We were entirely kept to ourselves. There was a wonderful fruit all around. There was a. I forget what the local town was. It may have been, I can't remember. But the social side, yes, we used to go in and drink in a local pub, which wouldn't have been a pub or trattoria. And the Italians were perfectly tolerant of us. And it was the most beautiful part of the world that I do remember. I mean, absolutely lovely. It is a rolling country. Fruit, chiefly orchards. But apart from that, and I can see again part of it in my mind's eye. And there was a chap there who must have been an English writer, because I remember he was a writer of short stories. And again, I ought to really have got more out of him than I did, because he was an interesting person. But that isn't about war, that's about social relationships.
Now this training took place in August. 44.
That's correct.
And the following month you were flown to Greece.
That's right.
During your training, were you aware that Greece was to be your final destination?
Yes.
And in the weeks that followed of the course, before you were sent in, what sort of preparation did you receive?
I had briefing from SOE in Cairo. I flew back from Italy to Cairo. I had briefing from SOE. I remember Alistair Matthews, who then went to work for BP, and I did have Alistair still alive. He briefed me. And I do remember the briefing because it was there I got the view from him, the view that your people in Greece had gone bush and that LS really weren't as bad as they were being painted. And as I said in my book, this appealed to my romantic belief in resistance, thought one should go with some sympathy towards LS. But in fact, the situation on arrival was very different. It was not as SOE and Cairo saw it. It was very much as the liaison officers were reporting it.
Where did you fly from?
Bari.
And do you remember anything of the airfield and the flight itself?
I remember on the airfield finding a bunch of leaflets that I had written or helped to write, blowing about on the airfield. I remember I flew in with Norman Astell of the Reading Support Regiment, who I think was a major. I do remember the flight. I remember flying over Corfu, and then I remember seeing the landing strip. We landed in the Pindus, and we broke, either burst a tire or broke a wheel where we landed. Now, for the next day, the Dakota had to be camouflaged with oak boughs to stop it getting bombed by the Germans. But apart from that, not very much about the flight. I didn't drink the flask of brandy which I'd been given. No?
Just to take a step back a bit, can you describe the political situation and the military situation in Greece and the Pindus at that time?
Yes. I mean, The Pindus was free Greece, in inverted commas. The Germans were beginning to leave. They were concentrating on the main towns and in the around the main roads out of Greece. And a large area was free Greece, dominated in the Pindus by Elas, Eyam and Elas, the left-wing guerrilla organizations, who were very much in command, and one had a sense of their being in command. And one had a, if one went from one mountain to another, one had a pass from Elas to get across to be to do it. They were still very cooperative. We were met, the plane was met by a group of British liaison officers and by Andartes. We went by truck to Grevena, the nearest town, and then moved on from there to Siatista, which is on Siniatsikon, another range of mountains. And at that stage, you know, it was like going into a nice peaceful place, scented with thyme and trilling with grasshoppers, and you arrived in the at night. But then, rather quickly, I got to a well situation because we did, and again, this is all written up in the book, we did an ambush on the Germans on the Kazani-Amindian Road, where we did ambush a small German convoy from which we retreated. We were then attacked by German armed Greeks in the villages in the Kazani plain, who thought we were Elas, or said they thought we were Elas, and who killed one of our party, wounded another, and captured a number of us, of whom I was one. And then they recognized that we were not Greek, that we were British. And we eventually were allowed to go the next day. So that was my baptism, 4 days after arriving in Greece.
What was the impact in Western Macedonia of the news of the landing of British troops in October, the following month?
Oh, rejoicing. I mean, there's no question. I mean, they're great. I mean, rejoicing until it was clear that it was not an acceptable thing to Elas. There was, people were frightened of Elas. There was very much a sense of oppression. And we were often welcomed quietly by villagers who feared, if they were too open in their greetings to British troops, that they would be subject to reprisals by Elas. But basically, there was the sense of liberation. I mean, there was a great affection between Britain and Greece, which still persisted throughout. So, and indeed, one has to remember, we were absolutely dependent on the Greeks. Had they wished to betray us to the Germans, they could have done. I mean, when we were captives of this German armed Greek villagers, a Greek truck, a German scout car came up to the village looking for us. We could easily have been betrayed. But I mean, the Greeks were remarkably loyal to us.
As the Germans withdrew, were arms still being dropped to Elas?
Yes, I mean, they were. I mean, the last drop, the daylight drop, I forget the date, was September. So they were indeed, that probably was one of the last drops, but it was a lot of arms, it was small arms and ammunition, and no way were they going to use these arms against the Germans.
Before then, did you sense from other officers that Elas were storing arms for later in the past and had been doing this for some time, or was this a recent
I think it was relatively recent. I mean, there had been civil war. There had been sporadic civil war in Greece, and there was latent civil war much of the time between the right and the left, or between the opponents of Elas, or EIM, and, between EIM and their opponents. And Elas tried to wipe out rival resistance movements, and which they succeeded in doing, with the exception of Zervas and Edes in Epirus. I mean, there was always a sense that Elas had a greater capacity and a greater weaponry than they were actually using in practice against the Germans. But I think it is really hard to know how much is post hoc rationalisation, because things became so absolutely clear after the occupation and after the battle in Athens of what was happening. But I think, again, from fellow liaison officers, yes, one got a very clear view of what the situation was.
With which other British officers did you work?
Well, Ronald Prentice, who was a major, was in command of that area. Pat Evans was up in Florina, and his signals were recorded by Nick Hammond. Trying to think who else. Kenneth Scott, who was an engineering major who had blown up, helped to blow up the Assopos Bridge. There was an American OSS captain whose name I forget, but might be able to recall. There were RSR, Raiding Support Regiment people. There was Peter Street, who was a captain. He was the most senior RSR officer there. There was a whole detachment of RSR. And that is a story, and incidentally, I know someone who is researching the RSR in Greece who might be of interest to you. Otherwise, I don't... Oh, I'm sorry, Graham Wrigley, who was wounded in the ambush I've described. He was a captain. I mean, Ronald Prentice and Graham Wrigley were both liaison officers of the British mission. Peter Street was with the RSR. There were one or two other RSR, Don Lambshead, I forget his name, Williams, who was killed, sadly. David Chapman, who was a captain, who was the RAMC. He was our doctor. He was absolutely first class. And I think that is it that I can remember.
How often did you see them? I suppose it would have been...
It depends where we were. I mean, quite... we were in touch by signal. Relatively frequently. But bear in mind, I was only there in the occupation for a very short time. And in a sense, I had the easiest time, apart from the temporary blip of getting captured. But, so I learnt an awful lot. I mean, I learnt an immense amount from that particular episode, because one could see the latent civil war in Greece and the fact how the Germans had tried to divide the country and create civil war. But I think one, yes, I saw them quite often, or could communicate quite often, either by someone going on a mule. There was even the odd vehicle running in the mountains.
How were relations with the Americans?
On a personal point of view, perfectly all right. And the Americans, I know from subsequent, they took a totally different view of Greece from Britain. They thought we were trying to retain hegemony over Greece. And there's a fascinating report in a book I'll show you later. There's a report by an American who's obviously totally ignorant, who suggests that Britain was trying to gain command in Greece, and that Monty Woodhouse, who of course was commanding officer of the British mission, had great economic interests in Greece, which is absolute balls. It isn't true at all. So I think at the policy level, there was a great division between the two countries. At personal level, they were perfectly harmonious.
Did you see much of the Italians or German prisoners of war?
No, I didn't.
And you don't know, did you ever hear of what became of the Italians or Germans in that part of the world?
The Italians had a terrible time. I mean, after the surrender, they were disarmed. There were a lot of them. They were kept in camps. They were despised by the Greek guerrillas. There was a lot of disease among them. And again, I'd have to, I think, look up what I wrote about them. I think they were in frightful condition, and many of them died through malnutrition and disease. But what happened to those who survived, I do not know.
Was malnutrition common to the Greeks in that?
Yes, absolutely. Yes, malaria was an endemic. One saw people dying of malaria, about which one could do nothing. the Mount Nutrition was common, yes.
How was the health and living conditions of your mission and those around you, the other British?
Pretty good. I mean, food was dropped in. I remember eating beans with a degree of frequency, which must have been a local supply. But no, on the whole, we didn't do bad there.
Now, when the Germans, as the Germans left, or as the Germans, when they, after they'd gone and withdrawn, did the attitude of LS change towards?
Yes, it got much more hostile. They saw us as the only impediment to their taking over the power in Greece.
Can you describe your experiences with LS during that immediate period between the Germans leaving and news coming from Athens of the fighting there?
Well, there was quite a gap. I mean, the Germans left. I mean, the fighting broke out on, I suppose, the 6th of December in Athens, and one is talking, you know, several weeks before that. Increasingly, they would give us demand that we had passes to go to A to B. I remember driving, going to Castoria, and simply driving a truck, and an LS soldier got on my running board and said, "You can't go on up there." And I said, "Balls" in Greek. I'm going, and I went. But there was obviously a great desire to see that we were controlled. And there were elections in the villages, which are totally dominated by EAM. So, yes, there was more hostile. But it wasn't universal. I mean, the individual soldier could be perfectly friendly, but politically and officially, yes, we were seen as an obstacle to what they wanted to do.
And when news came through, when news reached you of what was happening in Athens, what effect did that have on local tension and politics and relations with you?
Well, I have to go back a bit. After the Germans had left, we, I suppose, headquartered ourselves in Kozani, the capital of Western Macedonia, and fighting broke out in Athens while we were in Kozani. The news came. So we realized we had to evacuate because we were simply a small remote detachment. And I forget who else, what other troops were there. And I always remember we gave away our food to the local people. And as they went round the corner with the food, Elas came and stole it off them. So we realized that any supplies coming out for relief would be taken by Elas. And we then retired to Salonika. And by that time, I think we must have retired after fighting had actually broken out in Athens, and we drove to Salonika. And there it was a very tense situation, and there was no, fighting did not break out in Salonika, but a lot is written about this. I think it was part of the skill of RAP, RAPP, who was the consul general, and Marcus Vafiadis, who was in charge of Elas, who obviously saw, there was no point in fighting breaking out in Salonika. If Elas won in Athens, they wouldn't have had to fight in Salonika. And if Elas lost in Athens, it would be better not to have fought in Salonika. But in fact, there was a degree of diplomacy. And we dropped leaflets as well. I remember writing a note about the use of leaflets as bombs, because we had dropped leaflets on Salonika to the Elas troops to try and get them not to fight or whatever. And some of the leaflet packages didn't open, so they were quite dangerous. Hence the use of leaflets as bombs. And we also found many of the leaflets in the public loo, so I don't know how many were read, since newspaper was the basic bump in those days.
What do you recall of Salonika itself at that point?
Oh,
what sort of physical shape was the city in?
Oh, cold and grim, electricity, very, very spasmodic. Elas, heavily armed, on the streets, a total grip on the city, and fear. I mean, it was winter, but it also feels like being winter. You know, the memory of it is winter, and of course it was winter. I mean, cold wind, probably snow. Very, very difficult, very grim, very tense. And in fact, we started off by having billets in the centre of the town. We eventually moved to a small perimeter in case we were attacked.
what happened in Salonika in the end, from there, over the next few weeks?
This tense situation continued until the end of fighting in Athens, and the truce agreement led to Elias withdrawing to defined boundary lines outside Salonika, and British tanks came up to patrol the boundary lines, and that really was that. And then the people were relieved.
From Salonika you went to Athens?
From Salonika I went to I then became part of the for what I had the intention when I went to Greece was ultimately to be part of a unit which was helping to restore the media, press and radio, which had been destroyed during the occupation, and this was called the Anglo-Greek Information Service, and I was in charge of Western Macedonia, and we were based on Veria in Western Macedonia. So I moved from Salonika to Veria.
How did the situation there compare to in Macedonia, the situation there?
It varied. You got Veria was right-wing, Veria was royalist, and you still had this basic, the king, so much was politics. The king had at long last agreed on, whenever it was, Christmas Day, 1944, that he would not come back to Greece without a plebiscite, which removed a great barrier, which stopped the liberal, moderate person being prepared. So the expectation that the king would be forced back on Greece had left, made many moderate people join with the left. When the archbishop became regent and the king said he would not come back without a plebiscite, this really changed the situation. But nonetheless, we began to get, because of the atrocities in Athens perpetrated by Ion Elias, they were terrible atrocities in Peristerion Athens, there was a huge, and a lot, in Macedonia there were mass graves, and there were people who had lost their families for political reasons to Elias. So the right wing came back abundantly, if you like. Veria was a royalist town. Naissa, just next door to it, was a workers' a factory town, very left wing. Edessa was probably royalist. Kozani was liberal. What you began to get was the re emergence of the right, feeling that they were now on top. And the beginning of the persecution of the left and of liberal left, anyone who was left who was not a royalist was seen as being against them. And you gradually got a situation where there were still communist guerrillas in the hills, armed communists in the hills, but gradually over the next 2 years, 45 and 46, the extremism of the right would push liberal, moderate people into the arms of the communists and into armed resistance. So over that period of time, and it was gradual, you got what would have been a communist rebellion becoming an actual civil war.
And what was the British reaction to this, these developments? And how would you?
Well, Britain was deeply involved in the country. Virtually, the ambassador in Athens was probably a great influence in the appointment of the Prime Minister. There were British missions, there were police missions, military missions, legal missions, and there were troops throughout the country, basically to guard the northern borders against attack from Yugoslavia, Bulgaria, and so on. There was a huge British presence, but there was very little British interference, except at local level, of the backlash of the right against the left. We found ourselves getting people out of prison who had been unjustly imprisoned. We got ourselves keeping communist newspapers going, which allowed us had their protecting against that being smashed by the right wing. There was a contradiction. We were there heavily influencing politics in Athens, but not nearly doing enough to prevent the backlash by which anyone suspected of left-wing tendencies was kept out of the army, which had been reconstructed, kept out of the police, and so on. So you've got a gradual polarization of right and left, with Britain not doing nearly enough to prevent that polarization. And indeed, as I was saying over lunch, sexing down the reporting which went back to the Foreign Office. So these real examples of just clear discrimination of the grossest kind by the right against the left simply were not fully reported back. So the element, and the, because civil war really started in Macedonia, which was remote from Athens, which tends to look at itself and not look at the rest of the country. I mean, the civil war grew up, or the seeds of civil war grew up in a fit of absence of mind on our part.